We have finished chapter 12 of this book, which took us 4 weeks. We're up to chapter 13 of the book, and we are into verse 3 of the Gita. And we do two verses today, two stanzas. Okay? This chapter is called Why Fight? Which is getting now really to Arjuna's big question. Okay, this is verse 3, stanza 1 of the Gita. Arjuna said, O Janardana, Janardana, Krishna the divine liberator, if, as it seems, you consider understanding superior to action, why, O Keshava, have you been urging me to this terrible action? 3, stanza 2. This apparent contradiction confuses me, Arjuna goes on to say. Please tell me clearly, which path will help me toward the highest good? So we're very glad that Arjuna has asked the question that we were trying to ask, because it started out, he was telling him that he had to fight. But then there was all this stuff about the inner life. So we have to now get it all straightened out. So any questions or comments from the last week that we need to ask? Okay. This whole chapter, this whole class only being 4 pages, when I was dividing up the pages of this book, intending to do 10 at a time, this nonetheless just seemed like an entire unit unto itself. And it just goes on and on and on in all sorts of directions, trying to resolve a lot of the contradictions and also putting somewhat into perspective some of the other things that we have talked about. Just a sec, I wanted to try to remember what I was remembering. It's a specific relationship that I can't recall, but it'll come back. It's so odd. The ideas are just out there. They're not mine, and they float, and then they sort of hint to me sometimes, and then sometimes they just come crystal clear, and other times they go off like that. And I sort of wait for them to come back, and sometimes they do, and other times they're just gone. A week later, it'll come. Oh, I remember what it was. And it doesn't really make a lot of difference how much I've thought of it ahead of time. But sometimes they're just totally with me, and then sometimes they're just like they don't want to be found for anything in the world. They're living creatures, the ideas. And I suppose it's your consciousness as the living creature, and mine too, which of course has its better and its worst days. The question that Arjuna is asking is really the question that you do get confused when you start reading the spiritual teachings, because there's so much emphasis on the fact that spiritual realization is our natural state, that's just who we are, and that everything else that happens is an aberration. And after a while, you begin to think about it too, and you think, well, I will just commune with God. Why would I not do anything? Why would I bother to do anything else? Except the very simple problem is that we find that we can't. You know, that it's not just a question of wanting to. It's just, you just can't do it. The communion just doesn't hold. Master, speaking very, very bluntly, talks about how people renounce the world and they go off to the Himalayas thinking that they're going to meditate. He said, but they really can't meditate, but they don't want to do any work either. So they just sit and read and gossip and eat. And gradually, he said, get physically lazy, then mentally lazy, then spiritually lazy. And he just said, frankly, you know, most sadhus are just bums. It's not like a very complimentary thing to say. But what he's really saying is that merely because someone renounces the world and puts on an orange robe doesn't mean they have a high state of realization. What he's not denigrating the fact that many sadhus are not bums, that they're really sincere in it. He's just emphasizing that it's not that easy to just quit acting. You don't automatically go up when you cease to go out. Sometimes you just go down and sort of into nothing. But Krishna makes the point over and over again that all action is meaningless unless it comes from the right consciousness. Even our scripture readings this week about the Martha and the Mary story are exactly that story of Mary communing and Martha serving, and the two points of view presented. And Swamiji, in our Sunday readings, corrects the thought that it's a question of action versus contemplation. It's restless, worried thinking versus calm receptivity. But that is the most important point. I I always sort of smile at this because so often over the years of having lived with Swamiji and served in this ashram, I've had the role of cook. In the first years that I was at Ananda, it was actually for the first 7 years, I never attended any Spiritual Renewal Week classes because I was always in the kitchen. And when at first I ran the kitchen, and then I got called back in because it was big crowds and other people weren't as experienced. And then when I finally was released from kitchen duty, Swamiji went on a very restricted diet. So I was playing Leela's role before there was a Leela. And while he was giving classes, I was somewhere else cooking his lunch. None of these are complaints, believe me. But it was just like I was always cooking. I was amused when I read Anne Catherine Emmerich's book about the life of Christ. She was a German mystic who had these visions that the Catholic Church has verified whether they're, I don't really know where they stand in the great scheme of things, but among other things she talked about on that terrible weekend when Jesus was arrested and crucified, you know, Martha was still making food for people. I mean, it's just so real. Can't you just see them? They're all gathered somewhere, and Martha, everybody's totally strung out and completely hysterical. Martha says, has anybody eaten, you know, in the last 3 days? Well, I'll make some soup. And it's just, it's a very natural thing to have had happen because somebody has to just sort of keep things moving and keep things together. So when Swamiji comes to our house, he always comes with a big crowd and everybody has to eat. In fact, a great deal of what happens around the table. So my whole conception of Swami coming is vegetables and soup stock. And I mean, that's how I prepare for Swami coming. There's not much sitting still communing. It's going to the grocery store and it's stocking the freezer and stocking Marilyn's refrigerator and just, you know, getting things ready so you can just, sometimes we have 16 people at the table, 3 meals a day. And sometimes the first thing I offer him, he doesn't want. You know, so it's fun. I totally enjoy it. But then when I hear about Martha in the kitchen, it's extremely real to me. Even if Jesus is sitting there, and Mataji and Mohan have been at our house and they also have to eat. You know, just like you suddenly realize, and often yogis are very regular in their habits. Mataji is very regular. She's very modest, but she's very regular. Just breakfast, lunch, and dinner. That's how Swami is too. Master told Swami to be like that. Swami used to skip his dinner, and Master told him no. He would skip his dinner to meditate. Master said, no, you should eat 3 times a day. So Swami's been very, you know, even if it's just a little, very, very regular to that. Well, all that has to say that I don't feel that that's a justification for restlessness or anxiety, but there is just this dual reality of life in this world that an enormous amount needs to be done, and it needs to be done by a lot of different people. And the reason we are put in situations where a great deal needs to be done is we need to do it. We're the ones who need to do it. Because that kind of selfless service is a lot of the answer of how we redirect our energy. And that's what these 4 pages are about, is about the necessity to redirect our energy. Because the Gita sets here, Swamiji sets in motion, Master's interpretation of this verse, sets in motion something that sounds so, in one sense, sort of like such a small and obvious point, but it's so fundamental to our right understanding of spiritual life. That's why I just decided to stick with this for a whole class. And this is this point that the natural state of our consciousness is to rise. And we need to say that really strongly, because so much of what keeps our consciousness from rising is that we're so convinced that our natural state of consciousness is to sink. And it's one of those, if you can just switch that orientation around, if one can reconceive of oneself as an upward moving being with a few rocks in the road, instead of a downward moving being who has very little hope of rising, it just completely changes the way you look at everything. Completely changes the way you look at everything. So much of the problems of our lives are just our point of view. It's very, very rare, in fact, I almost say virtually never, that we actually have a problem. I mean, internally, with our own nature. Yes, you can have issues. You know, people go bankrupt, people fall off cliffs, people's children get into a lot of trouble. There's lots of things that can happen that are big issues. People get sued and have to go to court, and all kinds of things happen. And they're big deals that we have to deal with. But most people don't have, they have maybe like 0.001% actual bad qualities. Almost all of what we actually experience as our bad qualities is the attitude we have to that 0.001%. And the way we allow ourselves to become completely oriented toward the thought that the natural our natural state is downward moving and it's only a fluke if we ever happen to come up. And once you can flip that around and realize that there's a God's energy is just pulling us up. That's really what's happening. All we have to do is just, as Swami puts it so beautifully, you know, our consciousness is like a helium balloon. It's the nature of a helium balloon to go up. I have this vivid experience of balloon. I don't know how many of you remember there was a silent movie, a French film called The Red Balloon that was some kind of a classic that I can remember seeing it at some stage in my life. I saw that movie. I was a child because the whole thing happened on a bicycle. And I was riding a bicycle somewhere like children used to be able to do. And there was a gas station having a grand opening. And the grand opening was almost over and they had one red balloon like this. I mean, I was pretty small, but I think even my father thought it was a pretty big balloon. And somehow or another, I persuaded them to give it to me. I can just still feel the excitement of that red balloon. Plus, I'd seen the movie by that time somehow. I had that red balloon. I tied it on the handlebars of my bicycle, and I brought it home. I just feel like a little kid. I was so excited. And I brought that balloon home, and the way my parents' house was laid out, there was an internal hall, and all three of the bedrooms were off the internal hall. So we closed the balloon into the hall. And, you know, it just seemed to fill the whole hall. I do remember it must have been big because my father had to duck to go around it. And then that balloon just lived in that hall with us for many days until it gradually, you know, got smaller and smaller and fell. I just say that because a balloon to me is such a huge image because of that childhood experience. The way I had to tie it on there and the way, you know, it just bounced in the air and it kept trying to escape from my bicycle. And I was so... I could hardly ride it, my bicycle. I was so excited. And I wondered if the balloon would lift my bicycle off the ground, you know, all those things. And we all know the experience of having let go of a balloon deliberately or accidentally. And just watching it, it doesn't have any regard for the earth. It doesn't have any regard for the fact that you wanted to keep it. You know, you had it on a string. You've ever seen little children when they lose it? Accidentally, it's gone. And then it just goes up. And it just goes infinitely, as far as you can tell, until it completely merges into everything. It's in many guided meditations and of the affirmations, the balloon of my consciousness filled with the bliss of love for God rises into the infinite. We use all those images because these are hard concepts for us to grasp. But you know that nothing has to be done to it. It's the nature of it to rise, and it fights against restraint. Now, if we can conceive of ourselves as our inner nature and the energy in our spine and our consciousness is just like one of those wonderful balloons that's just doing its best to, you know, to distract us enough so we'll let go of the string so it can just go up like that, or even in like the hot air balloon with the basket under it. Nancy Mayer, who is a woman of extraordinarily varied talents. She lives at Ananda Village now. She's the author of a number of cookbooks. She's an extremely gifted landscape architect. Before any of that, she was actually a hot air balloonist, which is something she did through college. And she did it. She brought her hot air balloon to Ananda. And the first few years at Ananda, for the 4th of July, she would blow it up and they would give tethered balloon rides. And in some context or another. Yeah, she was one of those people, and her husband would chase the balloon in the Jeep, and then Nancy, being a fabulous cook then, would do a catered gourmet meal, and you'd land in a field, and they'd bring out, Carrie would bring the meal, and the crystal, and the linen tablecloths, and in some auction or another, my friend Seva won it, or Nancy gave her a birthday present, so I got to go. on one of those hot air balloon rides with Nancy, which was really, really fun. It wasn't red, but it was very, very bright colored. Yes, no, it wasn't red. But it was most interesting just from a spiritual point of view. I mean, the many things were fun about it. One thing is you're so close to the ground, and when she's not filling it with gas, it's silent. And so what you do there, she has this huge gas burner, and she would heat the air. In this case, it wasn't helium, it was just hot air. She'd heat the air enough to keep it at the right height, and then you'd drift along, and it would begin to, you know, begin to lose its momentum, and then she'd turn on the burners, and it would get a little hotter, and it would rise enough. But a lot of the time, it was silent, because you were just drifting, and you're just a few hundred feet off the ground, so you can talk to people, and everybody's having a really great time watching you. But it was just such an extraordinary feeling of the up and downness of it, and they'd heat it up and they'd have to really tie it down with ropes and get it just to the right height until it's really straining. Then you all scramble into the basket and then off you go, just like that. Such a strong upward moving energy. These are really, really powerful meditations. These are really powerful antidotes. We get all these difficulties going in our lives, you know. We have trouble with this, we have trouble with that, we're so sure that everything is a problem, and we're so trained in this culture to try to solve our problems with words. And the ego is magnetized by the downward moving force, and so the downward moving force within us persuades us that the way to solve the problem is to get into it. And we don't understand that there is no problem unless we're in it. That's the joke of it. It simply doesn't exist if you're not in it, because it's all within our minds. That's all we ever experience. Someone was speaking to me about that today, just yesterday, about just the problem of just keeping the mind clear. Yeah, that's all there is to life. I was thinking today, it was a relatively young person speaking to me about it, and I thought, God, you go to school, you go through all this school, unless you go to school here. But you go all this elementary school, high school, college, master's, PhD, you end up with this huge weight of stuff, and nobody has ever taught you anything you really need to live happy. You may know lots and lots of stuff to be a professional. You may actually develop a whole lot of skills. You can build computers. You can, you know, do all kinds of scientific and artistic and so on. But nobody ever tells you that the problem of your life is your consciousness. And gives you any techniques for how to work with your consciousness. And so then you really get out in life with all these skills, and what you find is you're just filled with ballast. And you have no techniques for jettisoning it. Swami writes in The Path that story about when he began to feel for some reason a little neglected by Master. And he talks about how the 5-gallon water can had to be carried up to Master's room. And so he appropriated the job for himself and went upstairs. And he put it, just made as much clatter as he possibly could, putting the jar in there so that Master would notice him and come out and reassure him. And instead, Master just remained steadfastly in the other room writing a letter. And then Swami, his mind just went even stronger into this thing. Oh, you know, he probably says, there's that worthless disciple, Walters, again. Quick, let me dictate a letter so I don't have to relate to him. We laugh, but it's not funny when it's happening. And then Swami just became convinced that it wasn't that Master didn't love his disciples, it was him he didn't love. Like in the letter that Swami read, we read on Saturday night, where Swami says, I never doubted God's love, but I doubted God's love for me, an omission all the more poignant because of the selectivity of its focus, the way he put it. It's just such beautiful language, you know? God loves everyone but me. And so Swamiji was saying that he just was plunging into this mood, and he just, the more he tried to reason with it, the more his reason was completely obstructed by the level of consciousness he was on. And he finally decided, this is just hopeless. And he went down to his meditation room and he said, reason doesn't work. He said, let me change my level of consciousness. And he did a few kriyas and he chanted a bit, and he felt he was throwing off the ballast of all those churning thoughts. It was the thoughts themselves that was the weight that was keeping his consciousness from rising. And he took his mind away from those thoughts and put his mind strongly at the spiritual eye, and then did those techniques which magnetize, which first, you see, these are how the Gita builds on itself. For weeks we've been talking about withdrawing from the objects of the senses, not becoming attracted and then obsessed and then craving these external things. I mean, we're not talking about ice cream cones and things like that. Thoughts. Thoughts are the worst enemy of this. There was this thought form out there that Master didn't love him. And that was the thought form that his mind was, you know, grasping after. And Swamiji just withdrew his focus from that thought, which was of the senses, in the sense that it was external to Swami's inner reality. So instead of allowing the energy fundamentally to sink by the practice of kriya and devotion, he started internalizing, raising the energy, taking his focus away from the superficial level of consciousness called the mind and the outward moving energy, and began to tune in deeply to the level of himself where Master always lived. And then immediately, the entire delusion just evaporated. And did it ever exist? You see, it's such an interesting question. Of course Master always loved him. And this is where, you see, it becomes so interesting, because are we ever not a part of God? Are we ever less loved by God and Guru? It's so deeply ingrained in us that he will love us more after a while, isn't it? Think about it. As soon as I get my act together, as soon as I really meditate 3 hours every day, when I really get into the higher kriyas, after I'm initiated, when I get off of this, after I stop drinking, as soon as I whatever, then God will love me more. I mean, who among us hasn't had that thought? Who among us at this very moment, you know, deep in ourselves, doesn't have some part of us committed to that thought? But that's where Master said to Dr. Lewis, God loves you just as much as he loves Christ and Krishna. He is our common father. And that other thing that Swami quotes so often from that French saint, if you knew how much God loved you, you would die for joy. Now, is there anything in us that keeps that love away? Yes. It's all that keeps our consciousness lower than that experience. And the whole Bhagavad Gita, which is, you know, we have many, many verses to go, will answer this question, which is just being raised right now. What should I really do? Well, Krishna is going to explain the balance between karma yoga and jnana yoga and bhakti yoga and meditation and how it all works out. But it's all to answer this question, which is how do we unload the basket so that the energy can actually rise? And one of the just lovely points that he makes in this, besides the balloon and the ballast, let me just stay with the balloon and the ballast for one more moment. It's very, very good. These are just the practical tips of a long time on the spiritual path. If we can develop for ourselves, do you remember the Groucho Marx show on television? I mean, I vaguely remember it because I didn't really watch much television, but there was some, I'm getting so dated, you know, I'll say things like that. Most of the people who know are dead. Okay. My uncle is 92, my aunt is 83 or 84, and it's so interesting to just see, because, I mean, they say it themselves, you know, the world they lived in is almost gone. And so many of their friends and relatives have passed. They're sort of the among the sole survivors of their little clan. And there's just so much that was common to their reality that's not common to anyone else's reality now. It's just all so ephemeral. It just slips right through your fingers. And, you know, only little children think that we'll never be 92, but by the time we are now, I loved a little Reader's Digest thing when they took little children to a convalescent hospital so that little tiny people could meet really old people. And some very small child was talking to a woman in a wheelchair, and she said, you know, how old are you? And the woman said, 92. And the little girl said, did you start at one? The mind just can't go there. But our minds can go there very, very easily. You know how easily it just goes like that. So what I was saying was, the more you can the Groucho Marx show. The Groucho Marx show had some kind of a funny system where there were certain words that the guests didn't know, but the audience knew that if any of the guests said this particular word, then I don't know, prizes would happen or booby prizes. Okay, the duck comes down. The duck comes down. Yeah, I remember that the duck came down. If you say the secret void, you know. You say the secret void, that's more than I remember. But that something would happen from the secret word. I say that because it's very, very helpful on the spiritual path to meditate deeply when you're calm and clear and get very simple concepts going, so that later on, when you're not calm and clear, and delusion has you by the ankles and is pulling you down for the third time into the quicksand, instead of getting sucked into the particular makeup of this quicksand, you just have a magic word, ballast, holding the balloon down. Get rid of it. And don't, it's like at the beginning of the spiritual path, one is intensely interested in oneself. One is very interested in all one's karmic experiences. One spends a lot of money finding out about one's past lives and, you know, finding psychics and people who can help you understand. And one talks a great deal about the particular syndromes that make you happen. And after a while, one loses interest in oneself. One finds oneself to be really boring. And you also find that it's just really all the same. It's a little bit like, this is not exactly how it was applied, but Savitri, who still retains a little bit of her Memphis, Tennessee upbringing, when we make up our program guide, we've simplified it now, but we used to just make up all these different classes, but they were really just different names for the same thing, because it's all the same teaching, no matter how you slice it, with very slight variations. And she used to say, yeah, it's just crocodiles, alligators, and big lizards, no matter what you call it. So, what are you teaching? Oh, crocodiles, big lizards, you know, you just get right down to it, it's all the same. After a while on the spiritual path, you just realize there's the lightness of spirit that allows you to just live in joy, and then there's everything else. And it just, the details of everything else, it just doesn't matter. I call it generic karma. All karma eventually is just generic. And mostly, I've also found myself, that mostly insights come to me spontaneously when they're meant to. And they rarely come to me when I sit down and try to have them, you know, try to understand why I'm feeling this way. They just don't come, because when you're trying to understand why you're feeling this way, you've lowered your vibration. And if you've lowered your vibration, all you're going to have is just reason running in circles. You won't have intuition. The only way you can have intuitive understanding is if you're not there. You see how it's a catch-22? So you just come to the point where it's just like, as Swamiji says, you acknowledge that you made a mistake, you observe it, you recognize that it was yours, you think in the moment, is there anything I can learn from this? And then you just put it out of your mind. Because you just won't learn more from obsessing about it. As Swami said very vividly once, he said, if you just keep pouring dirt on your head and calling yourself guilty, all the attention is on the dirt and on your head, which doesn't really take you anywhere that you want to go spiritually. I think of it also like a game of King of the Mountain. Once, when we still had the San Francisco house, which was, you know, many years ago, that house closed up. We've been here 20. It closed up in the first few years that we were here, so it was a long time ago. We had this mansion, we, the collective Ananda we. I never actually lived there. But we had this 5-story mansion at Broadway and Fillmore in the Pacific Heights for about 10 years, in fact. And for a time, Jyotish and Devi lived there with their son, who was called Kalidasa then, and Lakshmi lived there with her son, who was called Yogesh, who's now called Yogesh again. Yogesh went into his English name, and then all his friends said, wow, you have a cool name like Yogesh, why are you calling yourself anything else? So he went back to it. But Yogesh and Kalidasa must have been about 5, and Yogesh about 4, something like that. They were small boys. And for some reason I was there, and I had the duty, privilege, opportunity to take these 2 boys out for the afternoon. And we went into Golden Gate Park, and we found a piece of Golden Gate Park, and I don't know whether it was under construction or what, but there were sand dunes. And I don't mean like sand dunes. I mean like 4-story sand dunes. And I had 2 little boys. Can you imagine? And they just went up and down. And, you know, I'd watched for a few minutes and I realized there was no way they could hurt themselves. They could get extremely high and roll and jump, and it was completely undangerous. And they just had a magnificent time. And they inevitably played King of the Mountain, as little boys like to compete. So they just started, you know, pushing and playing like that. And ever since I vividly watched those two little boys struggle to be the one at the pinnacle of the sand dune, that game, which I'd never played as a child, has always been a marvelous karmic thing to me. Because it's just like you're just standing there. You've reached the pinnacle of whatever your state of peace might be. And in this case, there was only one boy, but often when there's crowds, there's swarms of little children who come racing up the hill, and they have only one objective, really, and they just want to knock you off. That's all. They don't have a very refined sense of anything. And you, if you're going to play the game well, you can't really be very engaged in who's pushing you where and when and why, and you don't really analyze the backgrounds of each one and how it came that this one got to the top first and why he's particularly strong. You don't think of anything of that. You just want to shake them off your ankles and hold your position. And over many years, I've just come to understand that's all that happens in life. You're trying to hold your position of centered calmness and awareness of God and allowing the upward moving energy in you to have the ascendancy, which is a pun, I suppose, you know, to be the ascendant energy. And all of these different forces will try to pull you off. And it doesn't make the slightest difference what the details are. Really think about it. It doesn't make a whit of difference because you're either centered and God conscious or you've been knocked off by something that was bigger than your capacity to hold that centered position. And the less attention you pay to what specifically is biting at your ankles, the more power you have just simply to hold that position. So all karma is just generic. I mean, it happens to be the karma that comes to you, but who cares? And it's a very interesting idea to cultivate when, remember early, much earlier in the Gita readings, there was the, I remember talking, and I don't remember what verse it was about, where Swami said the nature of delusion is that it demands that you relate to it. And that's the fundamental delusion itself, is that it demands that you relate to it. It makes you think that what holds you back is important. It isn't. The most important thing is simply that you not allow it to hold you back. Because it is our nature to be light. And this is just such a beautiful image I was going to say a few minutes ago. Just as there is gravity, the downward pulling energy of our habitual outward consciousness, God's love is also a kind of gravity drawing us up. You know, has the same force. In fact, a more powerful force, ultimately, that we're not doing this with our own power. We're trying to get ourselves unstuck so that the natural love of God will just pull us forward. And so if we think at all times, just developing this image of the fact that God is always pulling on us. And if we don't rise, it's only because we're pulling too hard in resistance. Do you see what I mean? It's just overcoming our resistance. That's how he also puts it in here. Let's see. What was the word I was going to use? Oh, later in the, toward the end of the chapter, he says, we don't have to create love for God. The most important thing in our spiritual path is to receive God's love. If you think about the Christ in the Bible, as many as received him, to them gave he the power. It's very interesting. I mean, of all phrases, that received him. It didn't say as many as loved him. It's those who received him. And think about the story of when Jesus was walking through the crowd and the woman who'd been hemorrhaging for 12 years touched the hem of his garment and she was healed. And then Jesus said, "Someone touched me." Now think about this as a real scene. The crowds, by now Jesus has been doing miracles. People know he can do miracles. And he's a real phenomenon, and they're coming to see him, and they're crushing in around him. He's trying to make his way through, and everybody's reaching. So think about the actual situation the way it was. that he was pushing through these very crowded streets and so many people were trying to get to him. And then all of a sudden, in the midst of this, he says something that just sounds incomprehensible to everyone else. Someone touched me. Who touched me? You see how difficult it is to be a disciple? Because immediately the rational mind just comes right in and says, well, what do you mean, who touched me? Everybody touched you. What kind of a question is that? I found this with Swami so often through the years. You just have to be really still inside yourself. Because so often what he says is so reasonable, but it's not reasonable in the way you were going. And it's not really like you have to make some massive other leap, but you just can't immediately jump in with your habits. You have to hold yourself just silent long enough to see where this is actually going. Many times I've made that mistake to very bad consequences for myself and others. When I just used to talk too much and talk too fast, just come in with some reality before some much more sensitive reality had a chance to unfold. But there it was. And he said, I felt power go out from me. In other words, some person in that crowd had a receptive heart. And so many other people were crowding up against him, but he wasn't able to give them anything, even though they were there to ask for it. Because they didn't have the inner capacity to receive. They just had their desire for whatever they desired, but it wasn't attuned to the actual wavelength of what he had to give, which is sometimes like, make me well, give me this, why do I have this problem, take this away, heal me of this, which is all just our own energy going in whatever it was going. But this woman was completely calmly attuned to who he was and had just total simple faith. And so just she touched the hem of his garment and he felt the power go out from him because she was able to receive it. Isn't that just an extraordinary story when you just stand back and really think about it? And so in this it says, the way Swami put it is, we don't need so much to develop love for God. Love for God is to receive the love that he's already going to give us. Because, and then Swami says this amazing phrase, how did he put it? Devotion is our response to God's call within. In other words, the inspiration to love God comes because we sense his presence, which is supremely lovable. And the natural response of the heart is to love back. I mean, how many of us, the first time I saw David, who of course eventually became my husband, I just found him very, very magnetic. He didn't find me particularly magnetic. It's a joke between us. Every so often somebody will say, how did you meet? And I'll sort of fold my arms and say, why don't you tell them, honey? And I'll see if the story gets any better. It never gets any better. David's sister's husband just tells this magnificent story about how he was a social worker and she came into his office and she was just the greatest woman he'd ever met. And he thought, God, if I could just have a woman like this in my, on and on and on. It's a great story. David just kind of says, yeah, there she was. Zip, zip. In the end, it had a happy ending, clearly. But I really liked him. I didn't fall in love with him. I wasn't looking for a husband. But he just made a very strong, positive impression on me right away. Interestingly, the first time he called my parents' house where I happened to be visiting, my father had no idea who he was to me, because many people from Ananda would call, but he immediately liked the sound of his voice. He said that to me. Who was that man? He had such a nice voice. Interesting, isn't it? But you see someone who's attractive to you, and this is a human relationship, where you just see someone who's attractive, and all of a sudden, you don't have to work. The devotion is the response, you see. You think about it in a human way and you see how it works very naturally and it's something you can grasp. The reason God gives us these human experiences, everything in the material world is a symbol of a more subtle reality. We have to keep always remembering that. There's a subtle reality from which this world descends. These are one of these things we have to keep flipping things around. This is the most gross expression of things that are far more refined. I don't mean gross in the sense of hideous, but gross in the sense of unrefined. Like saying devotion is the response to God's call within, and we think, what does that mean? You just think of anything in your life that you've fallen in love with, whether it's a rose or a sunset or a person or a baby. I was just in the shopping center near us. Yes, just yesterday, a very odd experience. And this 2-year-old child, maybe about 2, very sturdy little boy with a very elegant mother, and they were speaking together in some language, I don't know what it was. And she was a very glamorous, very attractive, glamorous person. The little boy was about 2.5, sort of chubby, curly hair like this. He was carrying a pig, a little pig like this. I don't know who that child was. He absolutely captured my heart. When they drove off, I could feel this just, you know, this extraordinary, it was just interesting to watch it, this pain in my heart. This little child I'd never seen before scrambled into his car and drove away from me. You never know what is happening. Where did that come from? Just this great call to this little boy who's gone, and I'm sure I'll never see him again. I don't really think it had any meaning at all in this life. But you don't ask for things like that. It's just there, and it happens. Now see, our relationship with God is all-encompassing, and over and over again, the divine has taken care of us. Personify it in the person of the Guru, or Christ, or Babaji, who has watched over us, guided our lives, protected us, given us exactly what we've needed for ever. God has been with us always, and it's just natural for us to respond with love, unless we get so selfish and stupid that we forget. You know, just like it is in marriage relationships, you start thinking, you know, why isn't he more like he ought to be? Whatever it is, whatever little thing it is, why isn't he more like he ought to be? Then you start thinking to yourself, because he's who he is, that's why. What are you thinking? But we just start getting into that, and instead of having the natural love of the heart go forward in appreciation, it starts curving back into itself, into all these, and we lose that call within. This is, again, think how God takes care of us so perfectly, and how many times we've seen it. And yet, instead of constantly responding with devotion, we respond with anxiety and concern, is that maybe this is going to be the one time that he won't. I saw this film, which is about Ram Dass, Richard Alpert. And he's been a character on the scene, and I've never been attracted to him in any spiritual sense, but of course he's been a character on the scene, and you all do remember him, even if you don't remember Groucho Marx. Anyway, and most of you all know that he had a stroke, and he developed aphasia, and he couldn't speak like he used to be able to speak, and he was always an extremely articulate speaker, and he was paralyzed. Now he's regained a lot of his speech, and he's even regained his mobility. And they made a film called Fierce Grace. I think that's what it's called. And it's just a film about him, and he's talking and teaching and talking about this experience. And he had this stroke, like strokes happen. He was lying in bed, thinking about this book he was writing, and then he fell on the floor. And just something happened in that split second that he had said something so cute. He was still in the wheelchair in this film. He said, "Everybody around me wants me to learn to walk. I like being pushed around in a chair." It's just so honest. Somebody nice is pushing me, and I'm the center of all this attention. But he, with his aphasia, has to speaks a little more slowly than he used to. And he would raise this picture because he's a disciple of Neem Karoli Baba, who was a very peculiar guru. And he said, "Everything that comes is God's grace." And he said, "So this stroke, which just completely took everything away from me, must also be God's grace." And he would go like this: grace, stroke, grace, stroke. And so he started saying he was stroked. He started visualizing it, that his guru took his hand and stroked him, knocked him out of bed, took away his speech and his ability to walk, and just trying to figure out how to put it together. And he was, as he does, he was sharing with the whole world what goes on inside his head, because that's what he's always done his whole life. It was just so beautiful. And he admitted, of course, it's not easy. But how can it be otherwise? And then the devotion is not an effort. See, the whole theme of this, these lovely four pages, is the spiritual path is not an effort. It takes energy. Let me phrase that differently. It's not tense effort. That what we're trying to do is to understand that. That's why I was saying again and again, it's natural to rise. It's not like we have to crawl our way up this hill. It's natural to rise, and all our efforts, it's a paradox. All our efforts are to get into that state of effortless ease. But of course, it takes every ounce of our strength and discipline and will to redirect our energy away. But even if we're having to work hard with our energy, we don't want to be tense in our minds. We don't want to be tense in our perspective on it. That's what this is all about, and that's how the balancing point comes, because even Swamiji quotes in here from The Imitation of Christ, which is this beautiful little book about how to be a devotee, how to imitate the life of Christ. We have to do violence to our lower nature, and Master's endorsing that. You have to do violence to your lower nature. Krishna's endorsing that. This whole thing is about war. This whole thing is about taking your weapon and stabbing and cutting off the heads and bashing to pieces with your mace. And, you know, it's not a pretty story. It's not just sort of quietly saying, oh, I wish you would please go home. I'm tired of you now. You know, it's not like that because they won't leave. You have to use all this enormous amount of willpower and energy. But what he's trying to take away is the tension. He's trying to take away the anxiety. He's trying to take away the fear somehow that it's not going to work for me, that I alone am not going to have it. And just that cultivating of that thought, it must come from God. And if somebody is loving you very, very sweetly, what do you do? It's just so natural to want to give that love back, isn't it? I mean, what else can you think of? Many of you were at one or more of the events with Vanmali Devi, Devi Vanmali is actually how she called herself, these last few days. And she has such a childlike sort of attitude toward life, and we've been living with her, and that's just the way she is. There is a picture that was on the cover of one of her programs, and it was taken at an elephant orphanage in Sri Lanka, and there's this little baby elephant. And the reason they use this picture is because it's so completely charming. There's this little baby elephant, and then there's her. And I looked at it, and I said, Mataji, I don't mean this to sound badly, but you and the elephant look just the same. And they did, because they both had this look of complete innocent trust. You know, just the little baby was just so little and trusting, and she was just so trusting. But it's not, I don't know any of the details of her life, but it's quite clear that her position has not come to her without effort. It's come with an enormous amount of effort, but it's all been a devotional response to the call of God within. You see, if God is calling you to something, and therefore you have to do it, and whether that is to give up a bad habit, to overcome a fear, to face into, you know, to give up a weakness or to cultivate a strength, all of that is a devotional response to God's call within. Because devotion isn't just, you know, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. Devotion is to be devoted to. And that's what you have to also understand. We think of devotion as devotional practices, which, yes, they are, and they do cultivate the love of the heart, but the word is much bigger than that. When we say we're devotees, that doesn't just mean that we chant all the time. That means that we are devoted to this particular cause. Because you can be a devotee of many things. You can be a devotee of the 49ers. You can be a devotee of the sports bar. You know, you can be a devotee of sushi. You can be a devotee to many things. Like, what are we devoted to? We are devoted to the understanding, to the practice, to the response to God's call within. Whatever that response might be. And we respond with devotion, which is with action. If action is required, with contemplation, when contemplation is required. But it's all one thing. It's just keeping our awareness on that reality and not allowing it to slip in response to what's coming to us. So we receive it. First, you have to receive it. If we're always walking around worried and anxious and concerned about ourselves and throwing dirt on our own heads, all we're thinking about is the dirt in our own heads, and we're not receiving anything of what God is trying to give us, so it's very hard to respond. And that's Jesus, that woman touches him, and she's just completely healed because it comes into her. And we can be healed in the same way. We just have to get over the thought that we can't. It's just a question of rechanneling that energy. That's what he also comments about. You just have to rechannel it. It's now it's going down, and now you make it go up. And you cultivate that also by our spiritual practices, the practice of Kriya above all. But anything that lifts your energy, anything that's joyful, there's a wonderful, in Whispers from Eternity, which is such a deep teaching and such an unassuming form. There's, you know, every one of those prayers, when we did the class on Whispers from Eternity, it was so interesting because every one of those prayers contains some really deep spiritual truth in it. And one of them that I remembered so well was, whenever you feel a little bubble of joy, whatever causes it, and all of us sort of seized on that, whatever causes it, just keep puffing it up and expanding it. And when you think about the eight manifestations of spirit, love, joy, peace, calmness, energy, light, sound, whatever, wisdom, I've always loved those because that means wherever you are, you can just pick whatever one is going to work for you in the moment. And that's how you make your response to God's call within. That's how you put yourself on the level where you can receive it. He speaks here about devotion as the response to God's love, but God's love takes many forms, and our response to it takes whatever form we can find at that time. So if we're not able to meditate, then we serve. But we have to serve not like Martha, all worried. We just have to put out a lot of energy to do whatever needs to be done. So we become energy at that time, or we become joy at that time. Or if things are very, very tense, we become calmness at that time. But whatever it is, we receive that vibration of the Spirit and we respond in kind, and then we can move forward. The only point is simply not to go down. It's just, the path is so simple. It's not easy. But it's very, very simple. It's a very important distinction because people observe that it's difficult and therefore they think it must be complex. No, no, it's not complex. It's exceedingly simple. But it takes every ounce of our energy to do it because day after day after day after day. You know, Todd and I made an agreement that we would be meditation buddies, which is something I incredibly highly recommend to all of you. I'm a person of my word, and Todd said, asked me to help him get up every morning for 6:30 meditation. And I said, sure. And so once I'd given my word, I had to. And every single day but one, once I didn't and once he didn't, and I don't know how long it's been, maybe 2 months, Monday through Friday, it's not a Saturday-Sunday agreement, but it's just... And it's just been so much fun for both of us. We just, no matter what, I just get up and I go out and get him, or he comes and gets me, and we sort of meet in the middle. You know, now he just raises his own board and signals me that we've met in the community, and we've just been absolutely solid with it. Now, where was that in it? Oh, it was just so fun to have the whole question taken away. Because I've always, from 20 years ago when we came here, this was a deal I made, especially when I used to teach 4 nights a week. I really felt that a colony leader could not be responsible for night classes and morning meditations. It was just a recipe for near death because I have to sleep. I'm not that way. But haven't been teaching that much, and plus it just felt like a timely thing. But just having the entire question taken away, because it didn't matter anymore. I told Todd I'd make sure that he got up. So, and then Todd is in his house knowing that I'm going to be standing at the base of his stairs, and he can't just leave me standing there. You know, he has to come downstairs. So we both just go every single morning. And except from when I was a nun 100 years ago at Ananda Village, I've never been so regular at group meditation, just every single day. But it's such I can't describe to you how liberating it is to just have the question gone, because now it's just an upward moving flow of energy. And you know, one day I was meditating. Actually, I did get up, but I was meditating and I was sitting there and I thought, this is not meditation, this is sleep. I recognize this. So I just got up and put myself in the appropriate place to be doing that. And then got up later and started over. And once I came out, and there was a little note on a little brick, you know, on the porch that said, "Have a nice meditation without me this morning." I don't know when he put it there, but it was there. But I had a reason for saying all that. Let me think what it was. Well, I can't recall exactly. That's simple. That's exactly right. How it's simple, but not easy. It's just a question of just day by day doing the right things and realizing that you really don't have any choice and you just might as well. Believe me, I'm telling you this story. I'm telling you that ever since I was a nun, this is the most regular I've been in group meditation. So you get a picture, this is not easy. And you have lots of ways of expressing. I'm not talking about meditating, I'm talking about the group meditation. But still, it was an important thing to energize, and so we've started doing it. Oh, simple and easy, that's where I wanted to be. That's why I so often say to you, you know, just get some images in your mind. Just very, very simple images, because they are your antidote to Satan. They are your antidote to Satan, they really are. Remember, I've shared with you many times when I, not too long ago, well, it was actually quite a few years ago now, when I don't know, something upset me, and I was curled up on my bed, and I was going to have myself a good cry, as women are inclined to do. And I'm just lying there, just, you know, making the pillow soggy. What was that country music song? I see my ears are filled with tears from lying on my back in bed, crying my heart out over you, right? So my ears were filling with tears. I love that. Isn't that gorgeous? My ears are filled with tears. And I'll just, this just simple thought came right across my mind. You're going to just finish this and get up and go on with your life. Why don't you just skip the whole middle part? I just did. I just got up. It was like, what is the point? And if the more profoundly and deeply, and you can't do it always in big ways. That was a big way. And honestly, I don't think I've really collapsed like that in tears since then. I think it was a really big moment that just said, forget this, honey. Why are you doing this? But practice when it's small. You start to get really mad at someone who's mistreated you and you don't really like the way they've treated you. Just, what's the point? I'm going to get over it anyway. One of your best friends you're mad at. I mean, David and I have always had a relatively easy marriage, but we used to hassle more than we used to. I used to hassle him more than we used to. One day I just thought, what is the point? You know, he's a wonderful man, he's a wonderful husband, and he just absolutely refuses to become me. And he's just not going to. You know, this is just so futile. And all it does is just make things unpleasant, and then they're unpleasant for a time, and then we get over it. What a drag. And most of the time, by no means all the time, but most of the time, I can just cut it off at the front now. You know, you just, Asha, you're going to start down this road, you're going to create a hassle, you're going to get over it, and it's going to be so tiring. Just forget it. Just stop here. Start getting moody, you start thinking unhappy thoughts, you start worrying about something. You're going to get over it. Just stop here. It's king of the mountain. Generic karma. My natural state is to rise as long as I don't hold myself down with too much junk. Okay, let me think if there's anything else. Oh, there was one last point that Swami said. Even though it is your natural state to rise, if you neglect the balloon for a long time, it can go flat. I love the way he sort of says that. You know, it can lose its buoyancy. And so it isn't just a question of not doing the wrong things. You also have to keep adding in the right things. That's why we try to have a lot of activities here in the Sangha. That's why we try to have group meditations. That's why we live together in community. That's why we have Sunday services. I was very fortunate in my early training, Sunday services especially, because we just, my first 10, 15 years of spiritual life, it was just never a question. It was the same thing as I was saying with Todd in the meditation. It was never a question about whether you came to Sunday service. You just did. And the community was so small. If you weren't there, everyone knew you weren't there. And where were you? I don't mean to go like this to people, but I always know who's at Sunday service. And I know who's not there. And I miss you. I said to someone, it's like, for me, it's like my little weekly party, and I want all my friends to be there. And I'm very conscious when people aren't there. I mean, all of you that I know well, I always know when you're there or not there. If you ask me if so-and-so was there, I'll always know. Almost always. I don't want to overstate it. Because I miss the energy. I miss your energy. When we were first starting Ananda, there was no Sunday service unless we went. It was a little bit like our school. We had to have children before we could have a school. But there was nothing, it wasn't happening unless we went. So we got into our minds that it wasn't only, we weren't going only for ourselves, we were also going to give. It was a divine responsibility to establish Master's work in the world, required that we be present and put our energy into what it is. I was thinking that a little bit with these pujas that Van Mali Devi's been doing the last couple of days, which is not really, I mean, she is a magnificent exponent of that ritualistic kind of worship, you know, like no one I've ever seen, ever, anywhere. And so she makes it very attractive because she does it so sincerely. But it's not really our way of doing things. We're yogis, as Swami said. We're not ritualistic worshipers. But she does these with a tremendous amount of faith and devotion. And there were a handful of people, relatively speaking, 25 or 30 even, still just a handful of people. But she's just putting this vibration into the world. And that's what happens every time we gather in here, especially on Sunday mornings. We just put this vibration into the world. And it's not something, you know, people can say, oh, well, you know, so-and-so's a good speaker and I like them, so-and-so isn't, I don't want to hear them, I don't feel like it today. All those different things. That's what I've enjoyed so much about this deal I made with Todd. I just, who cares whether I like it or not? We just agreed to do it, so we just do it. And somehow I made a deal with God that I go to Sunday service. I mean, now I give them, so I have to show up, but I didn't used to. But it was just one of the things that I do. I just do these things because it's my response to God's call within. Because that's accepting it not only that I'm here for my own self-realization, but I'm here to be Master's disciple and to serve his work. And if we don't create the magnetism for this work, please tell me where it's going to come from. It seems it's not going to happen directly through God, or the way Swami puts it rather differently. He said this is an extraordinary divine opportunity, and if we don't accept it, God will give the blessing to someone else. Which is a reverse way of saying it. But that's how he generally puts it. If we don't take this, he said, this is a divine work that will happen and God will find an instrument. But we have the good karma to be in a position where we can serve it. And we serve it simply by saying yes, a response to God's call within. And I'm not talking about institutional religion here. I'm not saying if you don't come to Mass, you'll go to hell, because you won't. But it's embracing wholeheartedly everything that comes with being a disciple. And we happened to pick a master who came at a transition between Kali and Dwapara Yuga, and he's doing a work. So we've got a job. You know, sometimes like Van Mali, you know, she does her puja, that's her job, but she goes out, she teaches, she travels now a couple of months a year, she receives people at her ashram, and she serves, but you know, so much more, it's a more inward kind of service. She's fully engaged and does it because Van Mali tells her to, Van Mali meaning Krishna. And so it's what she's supposed to do. But we have this, you know, we're the disciples of a world-changing avatar, and we have Swamiji who's his chosen channel, and, you know, we've got this big story that we have to deal with all the time. We should go at it in exactly the same way that she goes at it, with his just simple, humble devotion. But every single day we have something that we have to do. When Master before, in the very early lessons, Master said things like, you know, you should give away, he had a number of how many copies of the AY you should give away every month, how many people you should tell about this teaching, and he just had little quotas, and it was right in there that you were proselytizing, really, but not in the same way, but it was important that you spread the word about this and not just keep it. And he had all these instructions about all these things that you had to do. Now, of course, it's a little easier for us because we have a whole context in which to do it. But it's interesting, isn't it? He listed it right out there after the instructions for Hong Sao and Om was how you have to keep the energy moving. Now, see, that's how we add lightness to our balloon, is that we do all these things that keep re-inspiring us. I mean, I think almost everyone finds, and I know sometimes one is more tired, sometimes the inspiration flows better. I mean, I certainly can feel it. They're just magic moments. Part of what the whole issue of satsang and group meditation, too, is you never know when those moments are going to come. And if you always say, well, I don't feel like it today, that may be one of those times when... we laugh about this. Swamiji's not well enough now, but when he used to visit the community, every so often he'd go to group meditation. And you'd just be in there, and all of a sudden, you just sort of realize, you turn around and realize that he was in there. The biggest group meditations we ever had were the next morning. He rarely came twice in a row, but a lot of other people came the next day. You never know. This last Saturday night for Swamiji's birthday was just exquisite. And you have a few of those, and you remember what you're doing. You just have to just keep that regularly coming in, and then you just don't forget. That's how you fill the basket with divine light, and then a bunch of the junk just falls over. As Swamiji says, the upward moving energy automatically dissolves the downward moving energy. That's what you're working with. So I think that's all I have to say. Is there anything, any questions or thoughts? Okay. That's it. Next week is the last class of this series, not of this book. Then we take a little holiday, and we teach something else for 4 weeks, and then we start up again.